Okay, Ramblers, let's get rambling.
Now where it is now, everybody wants a piece of the market.
Oh my God, that is funny!
I don't remember asking you a thing.
I'm funny how? I mean funny like I'm a clown, I amuse you?
With all due respect, what the are you talking about?
Oh, I'm sorry, did I break your concentration?
What the so funny about me? Tell me. Tell me what's wrong.
You represent the idiocy of today.
I did not know that.
English, motherfucker, do you speak it?
Are you listening to me?
How's my shit together? Is my shit together?
Nice personality combination, hostile and intolerant.
So that's it then. No one else really knows anything.
Well, North Bay Stacks and Jacks, I'm Tim O. We got Ricky Garcia on the board. We got Jim Lawler in studio talking about some sports today. And we have Jan Flanagan and we have Audrey Johnson. So we got a bunch of stuff this morning. We have imagine that. We have a bunch of stuff to talk about. Usually in this boring world we're in, there's nothing to talk about. But somehow today, I don't know, there seems to be. What do you think, Jimmy?
Yes, Chief, there are. There is. It was a interesting weekend. Exciting. Yeah.
Well, we've got all kinds of good stuff in sports, and why did I get the feeling that our Cubs, after hitting a bunch of home runs Saturday night, were going to come out swinging for the fence yesterday and do nothing, and they did. Did you notice two things on this road trip that were, shall we say, is it what they call it, harbingers of things to come? In the first game against the Phillies and in yesterday's game, both games had the team with bags loaded in the first inning, nobody score, and they get shut out.
Interesting, but I have noticed that nowadays. I mean, they're going for the long ball. They want the grand slam.
Well, why not? What was it? Chicks dig the long ball.
Yep.
You ever heard that saying, Ricky?
Never. What does that mean?
It means girls like home runs. They don't like bunts.
Oh, okay.
They're like Sammy Sosa. They don't want, you know, some other guy bunting along.
I gotcha.
It's chicks dig the long ball when Sosa and all those guys are doing their stuff, right? And that was the, nobody wants the schlumpers. Anyway, so the Cubs are, we got the standings in front of you, or are we going to pull them up here in a second?
I have the standings. The Cubs are still in first place. They are, St. Louis is still in second, they're four back.
What did you make of the, I was watching a little bit of the Canadian Open, was it, if were you allowed to come back if you played up there, aren't we mad at Canada?
Well, that's a good question, because the winner is now, has a right to go to the U.S. Open. I'm sure Mr. Trump is not very happy about that.
Oh no, that can't be right.
According to the news, that is correct. The winner gets a spot in the U.S. Open. Whether they can, obviously, they have to make the cut, but the winner has a spot.
Yeah, it's a. I'm going to say, off the top of my head, the guy from RBC, who, by the way, we clear through RBC, the chairman of the company was, they are the biggest sponsor, World Bank of Canada, and they were. He was talking about they are the third oldest open. And I'm going to say, without digging, maybe that can be your job, I'm going to say the U.S. Open is the oldest and the Western Open is the second oldest, which is no longer.
In North America?
Yeah.
Okay, let's find out.
It's pretty, because there are, I think the only open left, except for when maybe those guys are, is the U.S. Open. Open meaning anybody can qualify. Anybody, I don't know if it's anybody. Anybody with a, I think you can start the qualifying rounds, but you might have to have a handicap less than 10 or something. Western Open was like that, but every other tournament's all invite of some kind, some formula or whatever, and there's sponsors, exemptions, and all other good stuff, but every other one is open. So it'll be interesting to see. This baseball season is kind of fun, although I can't say that I was real happy with the fact the Cubs were on Apple again Friday night, and no place I went had them. I don't, I'm just this, there's a lot of things in this world, Jimmy, that I don't necessarily understand. But you can sell the same game to like six different people. So, like, I go to the Triple E Tap, the official drinking hole of Stocks and Jacks, and they have, to my knowledge, which is, I know they have the regular TV, I know they've got Fox, I know they got ESPN, so you have to have cable to get ESPN. I know they have the marquee, they've got the sports thing for the Sox, and they have the Major League Baseball Network, which is supposed to include every game, or at least start it out that way. They have the Northeast feed for all their Boston stuff, and somehow, now they don't get Prime, they don't get Apple. I pay for Marquee, which supposedly gets every Cub game, except the ones that are on ESPN and Fox, but then again, I pay for ESPN. So now I've paid three times, and I still don't get them. Why don't we try maybe a fourth or fifth place, or maybe we do have five places.
Well, I hear Netflix is in the running.
Yeah, Netflix wants to do it. They had one on there, or was that a football game they had?
They had a football. Well, Prime got football. Remember, Prime does have football. To answer your question, the British Open is the oldest in 1860.
Yep.
But the U.S. and Canada are tied in 1895.
What about the Western Open, which probably isn't even in there anymore?
Let's see.
South
African was in 1903. I'll have to find out about the Western Open.
We have that. We have the pretty hot basketball series going, and we have the pretty hot hockey series going. One of the dudes was telling me the other night that the longest plane ride from place to place in the NHL is from Florida to Edmonton.
They are saying 1899 was the Western Open.
Yeah.
So that would be number three.
Yep.
Or
it's going the way of the Dodo Bird. Because for a long time they made, since it was for caddy scholarships, they made the pros use regular caddies, and of course they couldn't handle that, right? So all they did was bitch about all the courses and everything, so finally they gave it up. But it was at Butler for a long time, so Butler didn't allow any women or blacks. Well, I'm sure they had blacks. But they didn't allow women. They still don't. Didn't, and Augusta didn't. And finally, who did they lend? Was it Condoleezza Rice?
I think so, yes.
So they got two birds there. She's black and she's female. I wonder if she ever plays
there. Well, you know. Tiger is both Asian and black. He obviously winning it is a member. My question is,
well, you didn't know if you won, you're a member. Well, those guys could go play anywhere. So, I mean, if what's his name, Rory showed up at Beverly tomorrow, I'm sure they'd let him on, right?
Obviously.
There was a question in Quora. Typical people, if you have your side, you never look at anything. The guy goes, why does everybody bitch about Trump playing golf so much when Obama played all kinds of golf? The guy writes back, hey, basically, you idiot. It's not whether you play golf or not. It's how and where you play golf. Obama played. Evidently, there's a course near Camp David.
Yeah, there's a course at Camp David.
Oh, there is?
Camp David itself, yes.
So you've been there.
No, I haven't, but I heard the reason it is because of Dwight D. Eisenhower, also a golfer, that when, you know, Camp David is inside a military base, and...
Oh, I didn't know that. It is? Okay.
Or close to one, and it is... President Eisenhower said, well, you know what, I'd like a golf course. Obviously, his predecessors, Roosevelt and Truman, were not big on the golf course, but Eisenhower was.
There also is one. There's one by the Naval Observatory or something.
Probably.
And that's where Obama pretty much played. But the other guy gets on the plane, and they fly him and the whole entourage down to Florida. Costs like $4 million a weekend or something.
Well, he does have a course in Virginia. He has Bedminster, which is in New Jersey, and he has obviously, two in Florida?
We got the Doral.
He has the Doral, I know that, and he has another one not too far from Mar-a-Lago.
When I played at the Doral, I know I'm being suspicious here. When I played at Doral, this is before he bought it, it seemed to me the place was all kinds of people working there, and I didn't think any single one of those people were a citizen. And I'm sure the second he bought it, he upped everybody's pay and made sure they were all citizens. What do you think?
That's a good question. Or he got them their visas.
Yeah, I'm sure it was pretty interesting stuff. I was this weekend, I happened to spot this Mexican family. I don't know if they're Mexican or Hispanic family, cleaning out some stuff at this person's place. I was kind of walking by, and of course, me being me, I started talking to the Hispanic people, and it was a family. And one thing about the Hispanic families is the kids are there. And the mom pretty much tells me, hey, the kids aren't sitting home on the couch while we're working. That's not the way it works in this family. I think we probably use a little of that in other families, but that's just me. Now, I'm going to say the person who owned the house was a Trumper. I didn't talk to them. I just wonder if they realize that those people are enemies. And he's hired them. He hired enemies. He probably could go to jail for 10 years if you listen to Carl, right?
That's possible.
I mean, does anybody think that this is all for other people? That this is a... What did your buddy Hemingway say? Ask not for whom the bell tolls, the tolls for thee?
That I believe that is correct.
Funny stuff. So what do you make of... we have how many people showed up to not see Caitlin Clark the other night?
That's a good question.
Those that don't know the story, the Chicago, what's the name of their team, the Sky?
The Sky, yes.
They play over in the Wintrust Arena, which is basically DePaul's arena, by McCormick Place. And they, what do you think, 10,000 max?
No, they played for the Fever. They played in the United Center.
I know, but was it 10,000 max at Wintrust or 8 or 9?
I believe so. It's not a big stadium at all.
No.
That is correct.
And so they've never played a game at the United Center, which holds 20-something, 22. Probably more than that for basketball. It holds 22 for... Anyway, they've never played a game there. So with Caitlin Clark coming here, they had such a great demand for tickets that they upped the price and moved them all the game to United Center. Well, of course, Caitlin Clark has a quad problem, so she's not playing for a couple weeks. She should be back, like, pretty soon. She's fun to watch. I mean, she's obviously really good. So the ticket prices went from, what, $100 to $5 or something?
That's a good question.
Yeah, you couldn't give them away, pretty much. And the league needs a few more stars, I think. But anyway... They were at the United Center for their one game, and they, I don't know who won, or didn't hear anything about it without Caitlin Clark there. But, you know, interesting stuff, what's going on in the sports world. I just wonder, as we start putting more money back in the economy, if that's going to start jacking up these price of these teams again. Because, I don't know, last week was, in terms of the market, was very unusual, and that the market was up most of the week, even though interest rates are up with them. This week we have the consumer price index coming out and so forth, but I don't, you know, we'll see how that all plays out, because they, we're way past, well, not way past, we went through the 4.5 number in the 10%, 10-year, and we're at 4.96 in the 30-year. I don't know that they go too much higher without the market paying attention, but then again, as of now, every day we go up, you know, which is relentless mutual fund buying. Everybody thinks everything's fine. The seven stocks keep going up every day. And the only one that's kind of a problem is Tesla. It's down another $6.79 this morning. What did Trump say that if he gives any money to Democrats, he will face serious consequences? Does that mean, are they going to kill him or what?
That's a good question.
What exactly is a serious consequence coming from your president who can't seem to put a filter on his mouth?
That I don't know. Maybe they can deport him. I have no idea, Chief.
Well, the couple guys want to nationalize his industries.
That's very, very, shall we say, dictatorial or communistic.
Something, yeah. Well,
that definitely is not capitalism.
No, it's not. It's not our... Well, let's put it this way. It didn't used to be our way. Maybe it is now. Maybe it is now. Don't bore me with Congress. Don't just send me a text. Tell you how what our side believes in and that should be the law, right? Don't have a judge. Don't have somebody actually be in court for 2 weeks. Let me know. Text me a message whether you guys are guilty or not, and it's fine. What are we going to go through all this stuff for? All it does cost money, right?
This is true. Did you have a chance to look at the Belmont?
I did.
Which was in Saratoga for the second time?
For those that don't know, the Belmont is usually at Belmont Park, duh. And it was a mile and a half. It's the longest leg of the Triple Crown. Well, now it's Belmont is undergoing a major renovation. They've had issues. I think the place is old, so they have issues with the stands and everything else. But they also have had problems in the track for years, where horses have gotten hurt there and had to be smoked, basically, on the runway. Ruffian died there, right?
I think so.
And so they've had, especially in the back stretch, where horses just come down and break their leg. And they decided to spend gazillions of dollars on a total upgrade, which is pretty interesting because around the country tracks are closing, not opening, but. Because they have a track there, Aqueduct, too. It was in New York as well, right?
That is correct.
So, the last year and this year, I don't know if it'll be open next year or not, Jimmy. They've been running at Saratoga. And Saratoga, I don't think, has the ability to have a mile-and-a-half race without going in front of the grandstand first, which you really don't want to do, I guess, with three-year-olds. I mean, if you have Arlington Park, for those who have ever gone there, if you had a race, if in the back part, the track was what, though? They had what they called the mile chute in the back.
Yes.
You start at the end of the straightaway, and you entered the back stretch from the mile chute, and from there was the exact mile to the finish, because you really don't want to start in front of the grandstand, because it messes up the younger horses, I think, somehow. So somehow Belmont had a way where they could do a mile and a half, but the race had been shortened to a mile and a quarter at Saratoga, and it was a terrific race. I mean, that horse, the one guy stumbled out of the gate a little bit. I don't know if that hurt him. But it's twice now, and it's this one horse has essentially outlasted the other one on the stretch. So now
yes,
the other guy ran 2 weeks ago. The winner didn't. So I don't know if that makes it made a difference because, anyway, that was...
Yeah.
But the... no, it was a fan. And plus, I've been to Saratoga. If ever you're in upstate New York and you like horse racing at all, the place is spectacular. First, the town is really something. It's like walking through American history, because if you lived in New York in the summertime and you didn't want to do that. If you want to read read a little blurb about what it was like in those days being in New York, I mean, nobody had any insulation, and that's bad enough in the wintertime, but it's also like really bad in the summertime, because if you have a flat roof building, you know, with the tar vapor on top, the heat just builds in the attic, for lack of a better term, like all day long, and permeates down at night. So it actually is if you have a hot night, it's hotter in a place at night than it is in the daytime, if that's considered possible. So in the book Arm & Hammer by Arm & Hammer, they talked about at night, everybody slept, and he, you know, this is a poor neighborhood. He lived up, you know, he's Jewish, grew up in the garment district, basically. He slept on the balcony. Can you imagine that, Jimmy?
Yeah.
The kids got a step, and the parents got the landing. You know, those old balconies went down, and they turn to go down, and turn to go down. The parents got the landing, and the kids got the step. I don't think there was guardrails or anything. So that's where we slept, which I can't even begin to think. I don't think I'd sleep too much out there, but that would just be me. But the rich people, the richer people, would go upstate. And if you drive down the main drag in Saratoga, or even, you know, the side streets, these homes are absolutely incredible. They're these big old Victorian kind of places, and they really didn't even have air conditioning, but the amount of windows and cross ventilation in there was really something. I mean, I don't know if they had fans, but you made the best of any kind of air moving you could possibly. And the town is that old, and the track is that old. They've been around since, like, they're like one of the oldest tracks, aren't they?
Yes, they're 130 some odd years old, if I am not mistaken.
And
one of the funny things was they had Terry Bradshaw. You know who was a very good handicapper in the 1930s?
I don't know, Babe Ruth?
No, Art Rooney.
Really?
That is how he bought the Steelers.
That's a
what was through his horse racing winnings.
Horse racing acumen, for lack of a better word.
And you know, he had I guess in the Steeler Hall of Fame there in Pittsburgh, there is a dollar bill that still has his imprint that Terry had bet him on the Kentucky Derby, and Terry thought, you know, hey, this guy, I know horses, you know, I grew up in Louisiana, da da da, and he goes, he beat me. He goes, after that, I never bet Mr. Rooney again. Because if you want to bet on the ponies, Mr. Rooney was actually very good at it.
Well,
I guess he was in the papers in the 30s that people wanted to know what he was betting on. He was that good.
That's really something. Well, the guy who bought Cag Hill, let's get the guy's name, I'll think of in a second. He was on the pro golf tour, and he wasn't that great of a golfer. But he was a terrific gin rummy player. So guys would win in the golf tournament, and he ended up with a lot of the money. Joe Jemsek. He was a character. Well, yeah, a lot of those guys had, had some other talents, for lack of a better term. And but if you like, an afternoon, I feel like I'm doing an ad for the guys. It's different in one sense that you go behind, you know, you got your seats in the grandstand, but there's also this big area in the back where they've got guys, you know, cooking burgers and doing all kinds of stuff, and a big outdoor kind of almost like a state fair atmosphere. And the horses are behind that area, so when they bring the horses down to the track, they essentially walk them right through the, you know, not through the crowd, because they have their own walkway, but you can see everybody walking by. It's not like at Arlington or anything like that, where, you know, they come out and all of a sudden they're on the track. Actually, I mean, if you like horses, watch these horses. These thoroughbreds are beautiful animals, obviously. I didn't know Terry Bradshaw was into quarter horses big time.
Yes,
but he claims he doesn't race them.
I guess he has gotten back into it. He does raise them, and you know, he does. What if people don't know, he lives in Oklahoma. He lives on a ranch. And has for years, and you know, loves horses.
Well, he just got into thoroughbreds, evidently. Now he plans on having a nag in the Kentucky Derby next year.
I believe so. The other one that they had was Bobby Flay, the celebrity chef, had a horse running at Belmont as well.
Really?
Yes. I guess he, you know, he was talking about the first time that he went up to Saratoga. He was 13 years old with his grandfather, or probably maybe younger than that. He went up with his grandfather, and he's like, he had been hooked ever since. And you know, somehow, some way, through celebrity, this got into, you know, owning a horse. And then I guess, as he says, once you own one and this and that, you're kind of hooked.
Well, Audrey, my significant other and our guest today, absolutely loves horses, so she would go to all these events. And when Terry Bradshaw talks about raising quarter horses but doesn't race them, quarter horses, raising them is a big deal, because they're used on all kinds of ranches and so forth. For those that don't know, a quarter horse is actually much faster than a thoroughbred in a quarter mile, right? Because they're designed to just get up and go. But they're not going to go a mile and a half like a thoroughbred can. Plus, they're shorter, so you get up and down on the thing all day. Thoroughbreds are huge. I mean, the last thing you want to do is you have to get up and down on a thoroughbred about 50 times a day like cowboys used to. But they'd have these big showings, and it's an unbelievable deal. There'll be big dinners for these people to show a quarter horse. There's all kinds of brands. There's cutting horses, there's quarter horses, there's Tennessee Walkers, and there's a bunch of different ponies. The people that are involved in this are kind of the who's who of America. What's his name? William Shatner. Was he Andalusians or something?
I know he raised horses, but I'm not sure what...
It was a specific breed. I think he might have been Andalou, but I'm not sure. But they'll take the big arena and put wood out there on the dirt. They have big chandeliers and have dinner out there in tuxedos. I mean, she used to go to these things. One of her friends had a pony. It was just a pony. And the thing didn't do anything but, like, pull carts or something. But I think it was worth $250,000. And it was a gelding, because it used to win all these... gelding means you got snipped. But won all these events. And she would, Audrey's hanging there. When she was sitting next to one time, you know what was bigger than this? The Land O'Lakes butter people from Wisconsin. They're huge. And I don't know what different types of horses they have, but that they show at these things. But they're not racing. They're just showing them. It's a, you know, I don't know if it's as big a deal among younger people today as it was 20, 30 years ago. But, I mean, people who are into horses are really into them. I mean, they have people that show the big, huge ones, the Shires or the, what's the ones Budweiser uses? The Clydesdales?
Clydesdales, yes.
The Shires are even bigger than those guys. They're huge. I mean, you can't imagine. And then there's, you know, the Belgians, and there's all kinds of breeds that I didn't know anything about until I met Audrey. But so I could kind of tell you one breed from another a little bit, but not like her. Anyway, so how's that for a whole industry that nobody even knows about that we're talking about today that you can't invest in, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, interesting stuff. When we're going to go to break, when John's going to come out, we're going to talk about a lot of stuff. You know, we were talking a little bit about the, when Jen and I were talking this weekend, maybe we'll do a little report today. We talk about it in every generation, it seems like. Well, if you're old enough, there's been 2-3 times where people, one group of people seems to be able to take by government edict other people's money, right, Jimmy? And when you look back at some of the things that have happened in the world that we maybe weren't alive for, but we certainly know about, you look at and the thing that's kind of turned me on to this is and I have to try and find it on YouTube or something, I'll send it out to people, is a thing Channel 9 did last week about the Japanese and the internment camps. Now, the lady said it had really very little to do other than the, you know, just the general fear that was running around with putting these people in the camps. It was some people stealing all their stuff.
And very, very true.
And when you think about, I think that's what happened during the Resolution Trust. I think that's what happened 2007, 2008. And to go back in history, that's pretty much what happened to the Jewish people in Germany. All their stuff got stolen, right? And then they kicked everybody out of their house and eventually kicked them into camps and killed most of them. But I think the motivation among the people who actually did it was stealing all their stuff. Imagine that, huh?
Exactly. Well, you know, as they say, stealing is the oldest profession. Besides the other one.
SP Futures up 6. The SP Futures up 6. Be right back. Stacks and Jacks.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jocks. With a devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here. Right now. Right here. Right now. Right now.
Welcome back, Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Howell, Ricky Garcia on the board. We have Jim Lawler in studio. We should have Jen Flanagan on the phone here in a second. SP Futures now up 9. NASDAQ is up 17. This rally is pretty relentless. There seems to be mutual fund buying, and you know, we keep saying all's good in the world, and you know, I guess, well, if you're in the stocks, it sure is. A Dow up 57. I know our people have had a pretty good week. We have gold and silver going up. We have all kinds of stuff. So, you know, I guess it's when you're making money for clients, what does my brother Dan say? The world is good, or life is good, right? And it is. Over in Europe, we've got I think just about all of this is due to this expanding money supply everywhere. But you know what? Rather than fight it, I'm rolling with it these days. I see it and I roll with it. Now, over in Europe, not as much. DAX down 130.5%. FTSE down 12, it's only 0.1%. CAC around down 12, it's only 0.1. So not much going on over there except for the DAX. Over in Asia, we've got Nikkei up 346, that's almost 0.5%. Hang Seng up 388, that's 1.6%. Shanghai up 14.4%. Asia stocks rise as investors digest China data, await Beijing, Washington trade talks. Every time these guys are going to talk, the markets run up, and then they never solve anything, and if they don't go down as much, do they, Jimmy? Very, very bizarre. I think it has to do with, like I said, with the money coming into the system, but again, nobody wants to hear that. Interest rates, the 10-year 4.50 unchanged, the Bund unchanged 2.57. And we have oil is up 29 cents, 60.47. That's as high as that's been for a while. And it's been pretty well stuck, 61, 62 for weeks. So this is a pretty big move up in percentage terms. It's not like it's going to 100 or anything, at least like today. Brent up 29 cents, 66.76. Natural gas down 7, 3.71. RBUB unchanged at 208. We have gold down $7, 33.38. Still pretty high. Silver up 29 cents, 36.43. Copper up 2 cents, 4.82. Foreign exchange, dollar's slipping just a little bit. Euro's at 114. It was under that last week. The British pound, 135.6. But actually pushing towards 136. That'd be pretty high. We have Bitcoin up $1,100, 107.525. So the fake stocks are up as well today. We have first traffic, weather, for sports, Ricky.
Morning, Chief. It's currently 6:35 a.m. here in beautiful Chicago. 57 degrees right now with a high of 75. Breezy with some sun today. A couple of afternoon showers and high winds. Today will be partly cloudy with a low of 58. Also, smoke from wildfires in Canada can create reduced air quality, so watch out for that. Phoenix, Arizona, 82 degrees right now with a high of 110. Sunny and very hot. Tonight will be clear with a low of 80 degrees. Traffic in Chicago. Iman Kennedy from Monroe is looking at 23 minutes. Iman Edens from Lynn Cook, 40 minutes. 27 minutes. Iman Eisenhower from Wolf, inbound Dan Ryan from 95th, 15 minutes. And lastly, inbound Stevenson from 294 to the Dan Ryan, 27 minutes. Let's talk about the Stanley Cup Game 3. As of today, the series is tied 1-1. This time, Oilers head down to Florida to face the Panthers once again at 7 p.m. NBA Finals Game 2 was yesterday. Thunder beat Pacers 123-107 and even out the series 1-1. Next match is this Wednesday, June 11th. Thunder at Pacers, 7:30 p.m. Lastly, MLB yesterday is a pretty bad day for our favorite teams here in the MLB. Diamondbacks lose to Reds 2-4, Cubs lose to Tigers 4-0, and White Sox lose to Royals 5-7. Today we got Cubs at Phillies at 5:45 and Diamondbacks at Mariners at 8:40 p.m. Back over to you guys.
We have Mr. Flanagan.
Yes, we do.
Good morning, all.
How are you, bud?
Good.
What's the good word?
Oh, it's another Monday.
Just another manic Monday, isn't that the song?
Yeah.
Well, so far, not so manic, although we're continuing to run up here. Now we're up 11 in the SPOOs and 24 in the NASDAQ. Sky's the limit on the market, eh? Sky's the limit on we're trying to stay out of the way, that's for sure. We're really, really careful on the short calls, boy, because they just keep running and running and running. Very interesting. I mean, everything is just... But, I keep referring to the Weimar. The stock market went up the last day the Weimar was around, wasn't it, pretty much?
Yeah, these look good.
I mean, I don't know what is going to happen for people to kind of get the drift that it's kind of not the market, it's the dollar. But I don't know, John. I guess it's never going to, that message is never going to get out there, is it?
No. Profiting your own time's time.
Yeah, it's a, how did we, there was a whole set of knowledge that came around with the inflation in the 70s and 80s that, How do you forget? Well, it's been 40 years, I guess. So how do people forget all that? They realize the good parts. Well,
that's the thing. I mean, it isn't like data or memories that you can hang on to or remember very clearly once things change. So, after a while, it slips away that, the things you've endured or the things you've gotten used to, and you don't expect them to come around exactly the same way the next time around, and they usually don't anyway. But we have been down a lot of these roads before and have seen kind of where we're headed, and it isn't like we're any better equipped now to deal with it than we ever were.
Well, one thing for sure, we dealt with it differently this time. When I say this time, the inflation of the last several years is instead of allowing individual people to keep up with it currency-wise, by in other words, getting the inflation rate plus at the bank or savings and loan, remember those things?
Right.
The Fed went out pretty much and bought up enough of the long-term bonds and so forth and blew them up on their balance sheet that the interest rates sunk way below the inflation level, which they didn't do last time. And that had to be, I think, done on purpose. And maybe a lot of it was done as we have so much concentration in the banking industries out there, just said, we're not going to pay it, or something. I mean, the idea of having an inflation rate of 10 or 12%, like we did those couple years under COVID, and people making 1.5% in the bank is, to me, something like that could never happen, yet it did. I mean, if you had your money in the bank for 4-year period, your money's, if you put $1 million in there, when you pull it out, it was worth somewhere debatably between $600 and $650 in current dollars when you pulled it out, right?
Yeah.
And I think we really just buried the wealth of people. You know, if you had it in the market, you know, you hung in there. Okay. Matter of fact, you might even have done better than that. But if you were just playing risk-free assets, I mean, you're never going to catch up.
And I can't remember clearly now what consumer credit interest rates were, say, in the 70s or 80s. And there wasn't as much consumer debt as, you know, we would characterize it today.
The credit card interest rates were not as high then as they are now.
No. And I mean, nobody would have, you know, gone along with 29-30% interest rates on credit card debt when inflation was what it was in that period. I just can't imagine people not, you know, being furious about it or rebelling against it. But when have people ever really had any power to rebel against things like, you know, the interest rates credit card companies charge? And then we got so many people now who can take advantage of by ridiculous interest rates, and, you know, they've lost money everywhere else, and they have to pay more than ever to kind of sustain themselves as they put more and more on their whatever plastic they have. So it's been, you know, this wouldn't have been something people could have envisioned 30, 40 years ago, nor could they have seen any way of living through it. So here we are, and, you know, we're, you know, muddling through, I guess, but I just don't see any way that this is sustainable for you.
And somewhere buried, I got so much stuff up here today with those articles I sent out yesterday, that I'm somewhere buried in my I use the term favorites, is the credit card history. Not only are rates at all-time highs, the spread between the prime rate and the credit card rate is also at all-time highs. So that the spread between what people with money pay and what people without money or have debt, they might have money, but they have debt on top of the money, has never been higher. So, you know, we can talk all we want about Democrats and Republicans, all these people, you know, bleed out of their mouth, diarrhea of the mouth about how they're helping, and yet this has been relentless for the last 4 or 5 presidents, and this guy's no better.
Yeah.
I mean, you're talking about the spread between the two is just absolutely incredible. And you talk about why your population is dragging itself down. I'm gonna see how far this time machine goes back. I'm looking at the debt clock right now. The credit card debt is $1.3 trillion. That's kind of a lot. I think they got changed around again. They used to have student loan debt, but at some point here, the student loan debt was separated from the credit card debt. At one point, it was together, it was considered. But the credit card debt is $1.3 trillion. Let me see how far I go back in the time machine here. How far do you want me to go back? We'll go to, Jimmy mentioned, I don't think in 1980, the credit card debt was $123 billion. So it's 10 times bigger now. Now, the total consumer debt was $356 billion. So that would include what? Probably car loans and... was there student loan debt in 1980? It could have been some, but not much. Huh?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, nothing like what we've seen since then, but yeah.
Well, total consumer debt.
This predatory lending, you know, label that was, you know, slapped on during 2007, 2008, and after has been going on for a long time. That's really where, you know, I would put the credit card debt problem in that column, because it takes advantage of people's hunger for, you know, consumables that they think they're entitled to and feel that they can afford. And to take, you know, it starts sending credit card offers to people as soon as they're 18, practically. And, you know, it gets them hooked. And, they, you know, they're bombarded with advertising to make their life comfortable and enviable. And a credit card is the easiest way to do that. So these people are kind of beaten before they start in life. And that's predatory lending, maybe the worst kind, because it ends up, you know, you're having to borrow to sustain yourselves with your grocery bills and your, you know, medical expenses and everything else. This can't be good.
You know. Here's what, boy, I see this. Both of you guys, please opine in on this. Now, I'm not saying this thing is, especially in history, is totally It's totally accurate, but they've got credit card debt in 1990, $642 billion. Now, that seems real high to me. I wonder if that started to include some student loan debt. Because if you go out here to 2000, they've got the credit card debt is the same number. 642, it actually went down. So how could it, does anybody think the credit card debt went down over a 10-year period? It doesn't seem right.
Why it would.
It doesn't seem right. I'll ratchet up to 2008, and it's up to 948. So it went up 50% between 2000, 2008. And then now today they've got it at, the total consumer debt was $2.5 trillion in 2008, and now we've got it at they took that one off here, but the credit card debt is up to 1.3, so I think there's things they're not counting in here in this total consumer debt. That's not on here now. I wonder if these guys are being pushed to take some of this stuff off, but the credit card debt is now $1.3 trillion. It used to be, they used to have, I'll go back to the last year, but I think they, or 2000, and, where are we? 2020, I think they had this all split out. They had consumer debt and credit card debt. Okay, mortgage debt, personal debt per citizen was 53,000 in 2020, and now it's got to be, I keep changing some of that around, but the credit card debt is $8,000 per holder. And they got rid of the total consumer debt on here for some reason. But the ones that are kind of crazy, Jen, as I mentioned once in a while, these, the amount of you can talk about all you want about the CPI and so forth, but when you start looking at median income, 43,000 now, 31,000 in 2000, median new home 411 now, 164 in 2000. You know, that's bad. I think there used to be they used to have cars on here. They put all kinds of new stuff on here and took some of the good stuff off. I don't know whose job that is, but anyway, when you look at the numbers, I mean, you know, the CPI is going to be coming out, you know, soon. Everybody's going to look at it. But if you just go back and by your own admission, I mean, look at some of the stuff that's come down. I mean, your phone bills on your mobile phone obviously have dropped dramatically. Some things have. The price of a TV has dropped dramatically, and those things. But everything else is pretty much to the moon. And the thing that really is something is the medical stuff. And I don't know what is in the midst of. Is this administration going to tackle any of that? Because it's been Democrats. Well, if you don't like Obamacare, you say Democrats bleeped it up, but it was already bleeped up before that. The Republicans, are they never going to do anything?
Well, yeah, there were rumblings to rein in the. Make some interest rate for credit card debt, and I don't see that getting much support, you know, in Congress, just because you look at Durbin and some of the other senators who are beholden to these companies, they're not going to go along with that. So you can talk about that as a rallying cry during an election cycle. I just don't see it ever working out to benefit the consumer. It would have to be a huge cut in the maximum interest rate. 15% would be a nice start, be fair, you know, when you look at what inflation's done to people. But I just don't see that being negotiable. I think it's a dead issue. So.
I mean, it's never going to happen. But the, and again, that was a Supreme Court decision.
Yeah.
That allowed banks to charge out-of-state rates into some states, and even if Illinois had a usury law, it doesn't make any difference. It's really, I don't know. I don't see any movement that anything is going to help anybody in the lower middle class. And part of this bill, it appears to be, you know, of course nobody gets a chance to read it, but they're going to cut back on Medicaid and some of those kinds of things. Well, one way to get rid of those people is just let them die, right? I think if you fixed the system, you might have enough money in there to actually take care of people, Jan, but you're not going to do it this way. But if you don't,
well, they're kind of throwing the eligibility requirements out the window. I mean, what happened during the, you know, explosion of immigration and healthcare expenses, and you can see it if you went to an emergency room or critical care place, it seemed like, you know, the people with the least claim to services for having, you know, not been in the country very long and not been here legally, didn't pay much or didn't pay anything. And the average person, of course, recognize that. I mean, everybody seems to pay something and more than they ever did before. But it's because they put so many people on these, you know, state programs and, you know, left people hanging to pay for it. And now we've got a system that's, you know, been, population has exploded in ways that, you know, hasn't been supplied by, you know, money at the other end. And it's pretty much off the books, really, now. This is what's the worst thing, I think.
John, why do you believe that? I mean, the
impossible. Well, I can see now. When I've gone to emergency rooms, you know, and listened to people being talked to, and, you know, what kind of insurance do they have? And they've got several IDs, and, oh, this is the insurance card that works for me, I think. You know, and they clearly have, you know, have not been assimilated in our culture, let us say.
So, anecdotally, that
experience has been multiplied by everybody I've talked to about it. So
I think people are being.
I can't be the only person who sees it.
I have unfortunately been in one emergency room in the last 2 years, which I ended up walking out on, by the way. The place was packed. It was like a welfare station in the wintertime. There's people I knew by name. I'm going to say not one of them, and there was the somebody who's not a citizen. They were citizens. Now this is the one place. The people that I know that are not citizens, they don't go to the hospital unless you cut yourself, you know, working or something. You go to a county or someplace. But I'm not so sure that you're not going to get a whole lot of illegal Hispanics that think they deserve a doctor. There's no such thing as a doctor that's any good in Mexico. I mean, there's no real care down there, and they're not used to getting care. I mean, we can blame all we want on a lot of people.
But that's one of the attractions fueling the immigration last time.
I know an awful lot of people.
It's a banquet of services from soup to nuts. You know, the first thing people got. I think
that's the story you're getting. I don't want to go down this road, but I mean, yeah. I think that there's an awful lot of. White people that aren't 65 yet that are out of work that are piling on the system too, because there's not much care out there. And who can afford it? Who even has a doctor that doesn't have a concierge deal? I mean, one of the
reasons we don't is because we're over serving our population. The paying population does not match up with the people demanding services. So
that part's true because we have people who are out of work. We have what was last month's numbers on the last Friday's number on the labor. We got only 59.7% of the people working. That's almost as bad as COVID. Those people at the rate we have in medicine today, there's no way that less than 60% of the people can afford the medical care for 100%. It's not happening, especially the way they're gouging people. I mean, I think there's a lot of problems in the system and people that aren't paying. I mean, that was the whole idea about Obamacare, is everybody had to pay something. Never really worked out that way because some people don't have anything. And we also have a situation.
Had to pay more to subsidize everybody else.
It used to be worse before Obamacare.
Obamacare didn't fix that point. I mean,
it attempted to, but then. But the prices went up so much, you know, some people on the show dug through Obamacare more than I have in terms of who pays or whatever. But I think the issue with it never addressed the costs. So it just tried to shove the costs around. And the problem are the costs, right?
That's the big problem.
I mean, and you don't have any... the amount of doctors you have now, they've had to join all these other groups. Does anybody know of an independent doctor? I know one. I have one. And she struggles to stay independent. Everybody else has to join some group. All of a sudden, you can't. There's amount of time you can spend with somebody. You've got every test. You got to, you know, make sure that they agree with, charge for. Some insurance got to pay for it. Medicare's got to pay for it. It's become an absolute corporation. Every doctor's office, and it's, you know, and it acts like a corporation. It acts. I mean, it is so totally messed up. Jan, I don't know. I mean, I can't even. But how many shows could we have before we even talked about it?
Well, I mean, you try to get an appointment with a specialist now. 6 to 8 months is the standard waiting period, and that's when you have things have exploded, like televisits, where you don't even go into a doctor's office. This hasn't freed up doctors' times, clearly.
No, it's made it worse.
It's enabled them to manage more profitably, so that they can see, people when they want to and charge as much as they want to. And meanwhile, it takes 8 months to see a doctor. So, a lot of people are dead before the times that they actually.
Well, that's what they'll say. If you really have a problem, go to the emergency room. I mean, if you have a heart rhythm problem, for instance, and try and schedule one of the better rhythm people, you're out 6 months. Well, if you're out of rhythm for 6 months, you're dead, right? So, if you're really out of rhythm, you got to go to an emergency room. And I'm sure if it's how many people have a cancer appointment out 6 months? And for God's sake, you'd be dead by then, right?
Yeah.
Maybe that's somebody's idea.
Well, I think that's the plan, really. I mean, it has to be. It can't be something that you would have, striven for or tried to allow to happen unless you saw value. Clearly, there's a lot of value because people, are paying for the nose whenever they can get in to see the doctor, bombarded by copays, and it's turned into the consummate racket in a way because your health is in the balance, and there's very few things people will, put off when they feel horrible. I mean, they're going to pay what they have to. They're going to wait how long they have to in order to get these needs addressed. So you got them by the throat. So that's just what they want.
Well, as we've aged, Janet, I know people that have issues, and everybody likes going to Northwestern. I mean, it used to be, in my opinion, the world's best place, but now I see people go in there and have huge procedures, essentially walk out without even a number to call.
Well, I'm talking about Northwestern because that's where my physician is, and that's where you can wait 6 to 8 months.
Well, that's what I'm saying, yeah, 6 to 8 months.
And this, so, I mean, the best, so-called best place is still a good one to stay away from if you can, because once you get into its claws, forget it.
Well, my doctor says for regular stuff now, she's sending people to University of Illinois here, hospital. She says that if you're actually paying, they love to have you. They'll take care of like a regular, regular procedure without a problem, and they treat you real well. How many people are going overseas to get stuff done?
Well, it was being manipulated a long time ago between the paying patients and the non-paying patients, and of course, what that really did was, enable, let's take Michelle Obama's position on the UNC hospital board as an example, where they were rerouting by their policy anybody who couldn't pay to other hospitals such as Mercy or Providence.
Well, they still do that. They still do that.
Well, of course. Well, yeah. This is how the big hospitals get bigger and they become conglomerates, and other hospitals go out of business or get be bought up at fire sales because they owe so much that nobody wants to acquire them or administer them. That's what happened to Mercy Hospital, pretty much. And that's a model now. That's how, these things are easy pickings for somebody who has got a business model just for this kind of, losing operation, and to take advantage, if they can get a buyer for it and the hospital stays open, which is kind of defying the odds these days. But, you find enough, ways of filtering the population to get people in there who have the most coverage or, the most expensive coverage or have actual money themselves, and steer your doctors and your staff and everything else to accommodate that population. So you get this completely stratified system now by insurance, levels and abilities to pay. So it's a mess. It's completely
that's kind of how it all started, the Obamacare thing.
Yeah. Well, and I don't, that did, it just it kind of nuanced and accentuated the bad things in the system, really. It certainly didn't fix anything that I can see.
Well, if you ramp way back to, say, like the early 90s, before any of this sort of started, the way a hospital would do stuff, and this is so, you think how wacky it is now? It was so wacky back then, Jen. They had people would come in. This is a friend of Audrey's. Her husband was a director of purchasing for, I'll just say, the biggest hospital in Illinois outside of Chicago. And I said, how do you guys get paid by everybody? And he goes, well, that's pretty interesting. We had a couple of beers, and he says, well, you got about 20% of the people have what we used to call a Cadillac policy. You know, if you had like the best policy from Blue Cross or somebody, whatever we put on the bill, they paid. And those are the people that, because the insurance, essentially in those days, to a large extent, was if you were in the hospital and you were paying, you were helping to pay for all the other people in the hospital. So they had these Cadillac policies where if you went in and the WIF had a baby, you were the guy walking around with the $200 bottle, box of Pampers, right? They'd send you out the door with $1,000 worth of stuff that you could have paid $50 for at Walmart, right? And you were happy with it because Blue Cross paid it. The next level was like insurance companies that had cut like some kind of a deal and didn't pay as much. And the next level was insurance companies where, you know, they're going to pay you $2,000 for appendectomy no matter if there were complications or not. That's all you got. Then you had Medicare, which paid sort of. They covered costs. Then you had Medicaid, which gave you $100 a day whether you sat there and whether they did brain surgery on the guy or a lady. So essentially, the top two tiers of insurance insured the other people in the hospital. But other people like you and I, in my insurance when I started trading through First Stop, I mean I was paying $1 a contract, but I was I would trade 100 hours a day at most. My insurance was free, and if I had a clerk who had a wife and two kids, I paid $75 a month for their insurance, and it was top drawer. This is 1981, and so all of a sudden, you know, it got to the point where every insurance company goes, we're not paying for that crap. So everybody started negotiating these deals, so the internal mechanism of insurance within the hospital started to fall apart. And it came to kind of a head when Hillary tried to do something. I don't remember. Carol claims that he read her plan and it was horrible, but the fact is it didn't go anywhere. She tried. And then the Clinton administration kind of fell apart on that subject, didn't do anything for 8 years. Bush comes in, he had 9/11, so I'll give him that, pretty much ignored it for another 8 years. So here is a problem that, you know, a lot of people like me identified 16 years ago is now front and center, right? So Bush ignores it, so Obama comes in, recognizes it as this huge problem, which there is, and says, well, you know what, if everybody started paying something, instead of the people who happened to be in there that had insurance policies subsidizing all the rest of the people, it'd be a hell of a lot more fair if everybody had to pay something, and did. And if you could afford to pay, you had to pay something. And oh, by the way, if you couldn't pay, you know, well, at least we'll take care of that. But we're going to get rid of this mess where the people have the better policy have to pay way more to cover the other people. So that, but in the midst of it, his lack of attention to detail. I think, you know, I don't think there's a whole lot of been wrong with Obama, but I think he might have been a little lazy. And I think he let other people deal with this, and they found somebody to write the stuff. And every lobbyist in the world got in there, and all they ended up doing was, if anything, kicking the costs up and making it worse. Because now by this time, the costs have gotten so much higher. The difference between a hospital stay in 1990 versus whenever he did this, was it 2000 or something? Had gone to the moon, so you essentially institutionalized the massive cost that had built up in that time frame, which didn't do you any good. So they kind of messed it up. But now, has anybody fixed it? Yeah. I mean, Trump 1 didn't, Biden didn't, now Trump 2 has no intention either. So all in politically, he foolishly did not get any Republican support to it. So now for the rest of our lifetimes and God knows when, the Republicans are doing nothing but bitch at the Democrats for doing it, not fix it. The Democrats are going to defend it and not fix it. And we're going to go broke because of it. I mean, is that a fair assumption or a summary of this or what?
Yeah, well, it's comparable to what's happened with public sector unions, Tom. And I think, you know, you put the medical profession in, you know, sort of the column of a bargaining unit that's got total control over the messaging and over the lobbying and everything else. I mean, remember when HMOs became a thing, this is about the 60s or 70s, and this was an attempt, at the time at least, it was pitched as a way of reducing the growth in medical expenses, that she would have some kind of way of determining, well, this, for this level of care, you know, this, you don't need a hospital stay of X number of days, really, and well, you can pay less for this coverage, but you'll get less, fewer services, and this is, you know, this is a perfectly reasonable choice people want to make. They decide how much they want to pay for the insurance, and they have the consequence then of taking the care that that thing offers. And the idea was, and of course this had, didn't have any effect on it at all, really, that this would somehow keep the medical profession in line and give it a kind of, you know, standard of care with, you know, targets of how much you didn't have to charge somebody for something, and this was a reasonable rate, and you had doctors who would work within those systems and networks and were okay with it. Well, I think that model has just, you know, kind of become a laughing stock. I mean, there still are HMOs, but it isn't like, you know, anybody is paying less for medical care, and it's just become a factor.
Well, when you,
how much more you pay.
You're, don't take this wrong, you're aging on me. You're describing a time when doctors made the money. We're way beyond that. Doctors aren't making the money.
Doctors are not calling the shots anymore.
And they're not making the dough. They're nowhere near the highest paid people in the system.
And they're not making the dough. But the ones that are, and you can see this in the way, you know, practices are, you know, owned by hospitals, you know, and by medical groups, and, you know, but the doctors are just employees, and not very well paid employees either.
No, yeah, that's a, I mean, the head of the places are making the dough. The head of, you know, advocate.
It's comparable to what's happened in education, Tom. I mean, the teachers' union comparison is to me a pretty good one, because you've got monstrosities now where you got more administrators than you have teachers.
Yeah.
And in some districts, probably teachers are not very well paid. They're certainly very well paid in most big cities, I think, for what they do anyway, what they accomplish. But the real, you know, the mess of, you know, this kind of, if people need medical care, they need education for their children, you know, public education, health care. These are silos that are all now being run the same way, and they're running the population into the ground too. Well, there's just, there's no control on cost. There's no control on, you know, fairness at all. And you got uneducated.
Well, they're never. I mean, if you look at economics, and you know, I know I'm being weird here by saying that you have to look at medical care. I mean, economics can explain it really better than any other area, Jan. If you were to define economics, what's your definition, you and Jimmy?
Well, supply-demand.
No. Jim?
I would go with supply and demand.
Okay, you guys would be wrong-o.
Okay, that's why it's an English major.
That's why. It's the apportionment of scarcity. How do you apportion scarcity? I mean,
that's controlling supply.
No. It's coming from the beginning. If everybody had a replicator, like on the Enterprise, and you could walk over and say bacon and eggs and coffee, you wouldn't need economics. It's how do you apportion the fact that there's not enough to go around for everybody? You can do it by communism. You can do it by socialism. You can do it.
That's how you manage supply and demand.
But my point is, to understand the medical system, you have to understand that there's not enough to go around for everybody at the level everybody would like to have. I mean, we can talk. I mean, you and I and Jimmy and well, Ricky, who's been here for a while, understand that our idea of what we demand in the Chicago area, and by, you know, I'm going to say our, not necessarily our income level, but our knowledge of the stuff, we're going to find, to the extent we can, the best person in the industry to deal with somebody, us, our friends, our family. If we're out in the road in Mississippi, black or white, we don't even have an idea what, for any kind of injury or disease, what it is you and I and Jimmy are able to demand. HMO was a way to deal with that scarcity. HMO is almost exact similar as the Canadian system, by the way. And Now the other stuff, and now a person who lives maybe in Centralia, Illinois, has a better idea, as and will get somewhat better care than the person in Mississippi or West Virginia, but it's not like what we expect. And if they have a heart rhythm problem, they don't even know what it is. They'll go to some heart specialist, and maybe if it keeps up and they can't fix it, they'll find a way to get to a university center 6 months or a year from now. But they're not going to get the best guy at Northwestern or Loyola or North Shore like you or I could. They don't even know the guy exists. So I mean, there is a dramatic scarcity, and that's why I think people always jump all over, some of the immigration people or some of the Hispanic people. John, they don't know more. They have no more demand two new hips and two new knees at age 80 than man in the moon. And yet people, we know, do it all the time, right? I mean, it is massive. How do you apportion scarcity? It is exact economics. They go from day one. If there was enough for everybody, you wouldn't need any economics. You wouldn't need dollars. You wouldn't need dollars in your pocket. How do we apportion it? The people with the more dollars get the most.
I would just add, Tom, that the good medical care, I mean, assuming people, in Chicago, for example, have a higher expectation of what it's going to take to make them feel good about why they're going to the doctor, I would say their expectations now are about the same as people who live in Mississippi or Alabama. Very low expectations. The same way we have low expectations about what our schools turn out. This is what we have to accept. Waiting 6 or 8 months for an appointment, that reduces my expectations a lot.
Well, Jen, I love your opinion. What's totally off the chart for me now is, remember in our lifetime when people started to, our parents, most of them smoked. Most of them, my mom made it pretty long, but a lot of people died young. And I was saying when I went to that a funeral 2 weeks ago, and of course now that I'm doing the show, isn't it disgusting when you get older, instead of just like looking at the good looking girls, you look at all this other stuff? I'm looking at the tombstone dates. Can you imagine that, John? Yeah, I hope you would have been there and said, let's go for a beer instead. All these people, World War II, Korean War, I'm looking at how long they live. 55, 60, 65, 62, 67. Once in a while you see a 71 in there. Those guys couldn't have been healthy. Could they? I mean, how do you...
No.
I mean, I'm knowing one or two. People, stuff happens, right? But I didn't see anybody in there like made it to 80. I mean, I know they gave cigarettes to stuff. I mean, when we were in college, even though medicine was not anywhere near as advanced as it is today, care was, but all of a sudden, wasn't it a massive thrust through all parts, and I forget which president it was. I mean, it could have been, Republican, Democrat, I don't remember. There was a massive thrust that we need preventative care so we won't have to spend all this money and other stuff when people get older. Does anybody give a crap about that now?
No, that's what was, the Surgeon General's report about smoking in 1964.
Yeah.
Was the first big salvo on that. And it really did have a tremendous effect on people's behavior. And it fed into an industry after that, the environmental industry, pollution, all these other things that were considered, hidden threats to health, and sometimes very obvious threats to health. But it turned into a kind of a crusade to get people to, affect public policy in a way that you didn't have to expose yourself to risks such as, horribly polluted air or water, or, behavior, characteristics such as smoking or drugs or alcohol or whatever else. There was a complete, reversal of this. So you had, limitations on advertising for alcohol. Now you have an explosion of advertising on pharmaceuticals. Is this any better? I mean, we're dependent on different things now. So I wouldn't say that it had much effect on public health other than to, put it in a different kind of profit center for the medical industry. Now they make money on drugs, but the alcohol industry make money on alcohol.
Well, if you're downtown, all you do is walk on a block, you're high all the time. But this does turns into real money. I mean, in Canada, I was only there, for a day and a half, but everybody I talked to, I talked about their health policies. And you know what the one guy says to me? He goes, "Where are you from?" I said, "Chicago." He goes, "Well, it's the same here as if somebody like you, looks like you know what you're doing, and you're in Chicago." He goes, if you're in Toronto and your mother has, a brain aneurysm or something, if you know somebody, you're going to get her into a hospital, or you can bring her down to the U.S., which if there's not enough room, Canada will pay for, and we'll get the surgery done. He goes, if you're living out somewhere, your mom dies. She doesn't get in fast enough. He goes, down there, the guy had been here in the U.S., he goes, down here, he goes, if somebody, you know, tears a ligament in their knee playing football, high school or college, he goes to the front of the line. Here, there might be three or four guys that need knee surgery that actually work for a living. He's, you know, they don't care if he's playing full, you know, halfback again in 6 months. If it, he has to wait in line like everybody else. Because in America, nobody'd want that, right? Your kid goes to the front of the line, doesn't he? Because
you hope.
Yeah, you would hope. He goes, but here, that's essentially what HMO medicine does. You can't go see a specialist unless you go to the first guy. And he goes, okay, well, yeah, you need to see a specialist. And then you go to him and say, well, I'm not good enough specialist. You got to go to this guy because he's like, you got to walk up the chain and get approval all up the way. Now here, you and I mean, if it was our kid, we're not going to go through three people. We're going to ask everybody we know who's the best knee surgeon around, and we're going to call the guy, right? And guess what? We'll get our kid in, won't we? Or try to. That in an HMO system or a Canadian system, that doesn't cut it. You got to be like everybody else, walking up and down the line. No. But nobody wants to be like everybody else, do you?
No. And here's a question, Tim. Do you know if Notre Dame still has an infirmary?
I'm going to guess they do.
Because my niece told me the other day, she just graduated from BC, and they had just gotten rid of their infirmary.
You know what, Jen? I was never there, were you?
Oh, yeah.
Actually, mm-hmm. I went there once. What would you go for?
Well, I had pneumonia senior year, and I had to go there one time to have sutures taken out after I had a wisdom tooth extracted here in Chicago during break. And I went back there, and the dentist told me to have the sutures removed in like 3 or 4 weeks.
So you were alive before they had dissolving sutures. How old are you? How old are you?
I'm pretty old. But they, it was a routine thing for them.
Yeah.
And they had their beds. I mean, it was one of the nicer buildings on campus, I thought. And they had a staff of people. And I think there was a doctor and several nurses there and some clerical help, too. But it was, you know, they had patients, people who were there, sports people and stuff, people on teams. And it was kind of like a triage thing where, if you're bad enough, you went to Holy Cross or Memorial Hospital in South Bend. They couldn't do anything for you at Notre Dame. But it was, you know, I think that was, you know, sort of an intermediary step and probably an attempt at managing it better for the university.
Well, they can withdraw you from the dorm where everybody lived if you had some communicable disease and stay there overnight too, right?
Yeah, remember the meningitis outbreak? Was that sophomore year?
Your buddy Monty.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I just went to... I just went over and got everybody who wasn't on his floor. So you weren't up on the good floor. If you're on the third,
I was talking to Marty the night before he was hospitalized.
God. Well, one of the guys came back with a meningitis, and it was right before break, I think. But yeah. Everybody, if you were on the if you were close enough to him, I don't know what they did to you guys, but third floor, all they did is gave us a bunch of, was it sulfa drugs? Something. I think it was sulfa drugs. Wasn't it? They just gave you these drugs.
I remember I was. It was a break because I was home in Chicago that weekend, and my aunt called my mother and asked her. She turned on the radio because there was just a news flash about meningitis at Notre Dame.
Yeah, yeah.
And did I know anything about it? Well, I didn't, and nor did I know it had broken out at my dorm. But when I came back to campus, you were told to immediately go to the infirmary if you hadn't been on campus over the weekend. So I went to the infirmary and said, sorry, I wasn't here over the weekend. Where were you? I was in Chicago. Oh, my God. Go, oh.
Well,
what
were
you doing there? I thought it was like Typhoid Mary or something.
Well, my interaction with that was he was on the first floor. We were on the third. So they just he had an interaction, and I said no. And so they gave you sulfa drugs. I think it was sulfa drugs. And we went home 2 or 3 days later, so my mom, of course, scuttled me off to our family doctor, which she had in those days. And he goes, did you share a beer with the guy? Did you drink out of his beer bottle? I go, no. He goes, did you kiss him? I go, no. He goes, get off those drugs, will you? but I'll tell you what, John, whatever they get, you know, and I was, what were we, 19? Man, they made me, all I did was sleep on those things. I remember how much I said to the doctor, I'm sleeping. I says, yeah, that's what they do. Get off those things. You're okay. But, you know, they gave... I think depending on how far distant you were, they gave you the drugs. They put everybody in the dorm on the drugs, I remember. Well, that guy was a character. You know, he ended up being a district attorney in Southern New York.
Yes, I saw that in the class notes, I think. Not too long ago.
He was a character.
Oh, yeah. He was a good guy.
Jimmy, the guy, they used to have midnight mass and coffee afterwards.
Was he from Staten Island?
Yeah, what did he do? He went in and put poured a quart of booze in the coffee one night or something? He was, yeah, he poured a quart of booze in the coffee or something. But he was a character. You know, he, talk about a stupid story. We had a rector, you know, he, pretty good guy. He was a Holy Cross priest, and he was a little out there. But he used to have this big thing about Christmas cards. And every year he'd go out and he'd spend like weeks finding just the right Christmas card. And he'd send them out and he'd put a little note in every one. He'd send them all these nuns and parents of former students and all kinds of crap. It's a massive box of Christmas cards. So Monty was the hall clerk, which means he was supposed to mail the Christmas cards. And of course, he goes home for break and doesn't mail them, right? So long about January 5th or 6th, or whenever we went back, you know, Father Tom is usually getting all this, you know, come back from people, "I really loved your Christmas cards, really loved them this year." So he's like, no, and then he gets like no calls, and a couple of the nuns call up and say, "Hey, are you okay? You didn't send my Christmas card." So finally, Monty goes out and he comes back trashed, and in the heat of drunken admission, I didn't mail them, Father. They're at like Goose's locker or something. Goose didn't even know they were in there. So he ended up mailing them like the middle of January or something. Monty did all kinds of crazy stuff, and he ended up being a district attorney. Not a district attorney. Was he a district attorney? He was a prosecutor of some kind. I can only imagine.
Better yet.
Yeah, what that office was.
I bring up that whole line of discussion just because there was a different attitude.
Yeah.
Dude, about, you know, the first step care. And even when I was an employee at Chicago Title back in the 70s, they had like 2,000 employees in their headquarters. We had a nurse on staff. You know, she was a Chicago Title employee. She had her own office. She had a stethoscope. She had blood pressure cuffs. She had all this stuff. So if you were feeling ill, it was just like being in high school or something. You went down to the principal's office, and she'd check you out. If it was serious enough, she'd send you to Henrotin Hospital, which, of course, no longer exists. And that's where they had an arrangement. They had medical staff there who were, you know, they weren't just allocated to Chicago Title employees, but that was the relationship they had. That's where they sent their cases. And I thought, you know, and looking back on it, this was a way of giving you immediate care, like an infirmary at the university too, without having to trouble the bigger system and get, you know, clawed up in that, you know, paperwork mess. And only then, if it was serious enough, did you, you know, actually get advanced to the next level. There's nothing like that now. I mean, there's specialists and there's critical care places and emergency rooms and all that, but generally it's not about, you know, really filtering anything and giving people immediate care. It's about making everybody wait forever.
Well, that's what a doctor in those days, Robin's brother, Robin the lady, used to do the show that killed in a car accident, told me when he went to Michael Reese. So a good general practitioner, he doesn't just sit there waiting for you to wander in. He watches you walk in from the waiting room, looks you right in the eye, sees you sit down, kind of checks your coloring. Before you open your mouth, he knows whether you're sick or not. Before you even tell him your problem. And
yeah.
He says that the idea that, matter of fact, my current physician, which you mentioned about Notre Dame, a lot of companies really took great pride in that, John. And then this, I won't say her name, but she was an assistant to a guy who had been William Wrigley Sr.'s doctor, like, forever, right? So she was this guy was a personal physician of the Wrigley family and helped out at all the Wrigley places, like here in Chicago. Well, it turns out he retires or dies or something, so she essentially falls into the job. And with her, she was still is, big things on preventative medicine. So she had the whole Wrigley family at all their places. They had two or three plants in Chicago area at the time.
Yeah.
At all the plants, they gave her an office, and then she could go, and people who had any kind of issue bothering them, or cough, whatever it was, there'd be a day a week where they could come in, make an appointment, and she'd basically take a look like the general practitioner would and say, okay, you got a cough, there's a cold going around, sounds just like it, or man, that cough's not a cold cough, you better go someplace. I mean, she didn't treat people, but she essentially did exactly what you described at the infirmary. Say, no, hey, no, you shouldn't be here. Go home for a couple of days, come back, blah, 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 that kind of thing. Take your temperature, you know. And it really, really helped out. And Wrigley's were really behind this stuff. And they thought that not only did it really help everybody, but it cut down on their medical expenses. There was an economic reason to do it as well. It wasn't just they were nice to people. There was an economic reason. And so they got bought by, who the hell bought them? I should know this. Jimmy, remember who they bought them?
Wrigley was bought by the Mars.
Yeah. Mars. As soon as Mars came in, they shut all that down. They weren't doing it. They didn't do anything for anybody. But one interesting story is the Wrigley's, evidently they took this tour someplace, some country you're not supposed to drink the water. Well, evidently they drank the water. So the private jet, they get back up to Lake Geneva, and everybody's in not too good a shape. They sent a helicopter to come down and get my doctor. That helicopter landed in her front lawn and took her up to took her up to Lake Geneva, and she goes, basically said, "Well, you got Montezuma's revenge. Here, take some of this for a couple of days and stay close to the can, and you'll be okay." I don't think helicopter back or what they did. It might have drove her back, but they sent a helicopter for it. It was all the talk of the neighborhood for quite a while. Landed on her front lawn. But they were really into it, Wrigley. And one of my my first clients here, the guy I talk about that had all the properties out in Arizona, and it was all about the Resolution Trust, which, by the way, you and I were supposed to talk about today. But in his place in Columbus, Indiana, he had a factory of something. I don't know the whole details, but and this is what Carl and I talk about, and I think you and I have talked about it, is the idea of this tiered pricing. There's really no reason why, if Flanagan, Lawler, and Howe decided to have a law firm, of course you'd be the only lawyer, and we had 400 people that worked there, there's no reason why we couldn't self-insure if the system was straight. Because and I'm not talking about, you have to have an overriding umbrella policy in case two things that cost you the most. By far, the thing that costs you the most if somebody has a kid that needs care for like 25 years. That's the biggest expenditure. You know, cancer's kind of up there, but that's kind of those kinds of things are worse because they just keep going on year after year. Anyway, you buy that policy, but for everything else, if somebody needs an appendectomy, somebody needs a broken ankle or something, you're way better off if you just put a whole bunch of dough in a pot. Had some preventative medicine at the place, which he did, and he said that they saved all kinds of dough over about a period of 7 to 8 years. But then it got to the point where if you sent a guy to the hospital with a broken ankle, your cost was three times more than an insurance company that's worked it down. That's what's caused everybody to have insurance. When I say everybody, every company. Because if you had the same rate as the insurance company, you could self-insure 80% of the stuff, right?
Yeah.
But you can't do that now.
Well, and the delivery systems were different. Do you remember the Chicago Eye, Ear, Nose, and Throat Hospital?
Yeah.
That was on Washington Street downtown?
Yep.
It was a full-blown hospital. I mean, it had wet beds. It had a big overnight. They had surgeries. It did all the specialized eye and, nose and ear surgery. But they had a clinic on the first floor that was open to the public. And if you like, I was a kind of a regular patient there. I still have ear problems all the time, infections or earwax or whatever. And I could go over to the clinic on my lunch hour from work, just walk two blocks and be seen by a doctor and get a prescription. They would fill there for whatever I needed, and I'd be back at my desk. I just skip lunch pretty much, but in an hour I saw somebody and was treated, and it got rid of the problem. And there was a huge room full of people who were being moved through very regularly with all sorts of presenting that needed to be treated. And if they were treated here as opposed to 2 weeks or 3 weeks later,
where do they even go now?
They can avoid a hospital stay.
Where would you even go for that now?
Oh, I don't know. I mean,
mean, you don't.
You can't. You don't have
a personal physician. Maybe you do, but you don't usually have a personal physician's office that'll do it right in there. I mean, my doctor, if I went in there and I needed a shot, she'd send me someplace. They don't even do that.
Yeah. Well, I went to my physician last September and asked for, I was experiencing hearing trouble, and he gave me a referral to an otolaryngologist at Northwestern, and I finally saw the person in March, 6 months later, after which my hearing had declined even more. And now I got a repeat visit with him in September. So I'm kind of like, if there had been something like Eye, Ear, Nose, and Throat Hospital, back like there was, if there's something like that now, where you get in and get out and you get treated and avoid living with some condition for too long a period, we'd be a lot healthier and spend a lot less money in the process too.
Well,
but those places, they were set up to cater to populations in a kind of, attitude, a charitable organization, that's about the least, close model you can find for medical care today. There's nothing to do charitable about it unless you get somebody who's half-witted and thinking they can actually make this work. But, there were places like this that were, committed to it, and some of them were in settlement houses and, places of employment, schools or whatever. I just think that was the first line of defense, The same thing that when your doctor came to your house for a house call, he didn't just look at me or my mom. He looked at everybody in the house while I was there.
Oh, yeah. They could tell by looking at you who the one was actually sick.
Yeah, well, stick out your tongue, Tom. All of us, while he was there, he was a smart doctor. If these people are living together and somebody's got something, chances are the other person already has it, too. So that was just smart management. And he didn't charge anything, really, for house visits. I saw him far more often at home than I ever saw him in his office.
Well, if you called in sick, they used to send the doctor to your house. You can imagine that now. What's wrong with you? I'm hungover. Well, that doesn't cut it.
I get calls from Aetna all the time. Did you know your plan includes home visits? Like, stay out of here.
Just as a way to, you can, curse the darkness, but the idea is to light a candle, right? If you and I somehow landed, here's what I actually think it would take, John. If you and I landed in the Oval Office, I think we would have to go to whoever the head of both parties is in Congress and say, okay, Senate and Republican, the Senate and the House, give me three people from each side, or five people, probably five, and go to the House, do the same thing. Give me five people that actually can do something and not just talk all day. And I would drag those 10 people, those 10 fish, 20, I guess it'd be 20 fish, out to Camp David and say, look, we got a year-long project. I want you guys, you do it. It's not my job. It's Congress's job. I want you guys to, if you need some, I don't know how you get special scratch-o or something, but some money, I want you to go around the country, not all together or whatever. I want you to interview people at all different income levels. I want you to find out what their medical care is like and who they go to, and I want you to go to those places and find out how they do it, where they get their money, where they send people. And at the end of a year or two, I want a full report that's going to go to both houses of Congress, and we're going to find some way, I won't use the term to fix it, but to do something maybe different that's way improvement. What would be the best system? And I think, John, you, by the way, just hit that on the head. You need to go a place to go somewhere early on and whatever you have so it gets caught early. So that if it is cancer, maybe we can fix the person and maybe we can do it with a little bit of surgery and a little bit of chemo instead of 6 months of crap that costs $1 million and then they die. Because that's not an outcome that anybody wants. A huge amount paid and they die, right? Not to mention the suffering along the way. I want to come back because I don't think anybody has the solution. I think you just mentioned, bright as you are, which you are, of what the stuff that's not happening that maybe used to and how it's happening long and people are being put off. So whatever it is they have is now worse. I mean, I don't know if you know it or not, but you just mentioned about four things that are really, really important and they're not happening. So the question is, I think it would take 20 dedicated people and maybe a couple, staff member, a person, some travel, some interviews. I think it would take at least a year just to get a handle on what we want, how we want to accomplish this. How do we get somebody, if something is wrong, that's not just their normal cold, to check something out? Maybe the drugstores are part of the answer. Maybe they're not. I don't know. It sort of becomes, that's where they are now, but I don't see any care there. They just give people shots that people kind of request, so I don't know if that's where you want to go either. I mean, I honestly don't know. But since I'm willing to admit that I don't know, and before I were to do something to fix it, I'd kind of want to know. Now, do you disagree with that or not?
Not at all. Not at all, Tim.
What are the chances of that happening?
Maybe there was a lack of... Well, I don't know. We've had a real trade-off because, you know, back, you know, 40, 50 years ago, you didn't have sophisticated testing or machinery or equipment to probe into a case. Which might have helped a lot of people save some of their lives, you know, back then had it been around. But you had something better in a way. You had confidence in the system. You had people who were willing to seek help and knowing that it didn't mean giving up a day's work, you know, and just, you know, paying an arm, you know, a bucket of money and be as in, you know, in doubt or clueless about your health afterwards as you were before. So all these people steered away now just from inertia. I don't want to go to the emergency room. I know what that's like. It'll take forever. I'll be furious. I'll have a heart attack while I'm there waiting to see the heart doctor. So, you know, what's the point of it? So all these discouragements to getting, you know, into the system when things could be, you know, turned around for people at low expense, really. But there's no way to do that, not even in the best hospital, you know, where big city hospitals, whatever. Those are the last places you would go for that kind of help, I think. So,
and some of the, you know, some of the care centers, I think, are somewhat of a good idea. I mean, it seems like some of these bigger drugstores. I'm just tossing crap out.
It's kind of like, you know, a way of yeah.
But I'm just kind of tossing crap out there. I mean, maybe the drugstores should have a doctor in there, or I don't, you know, where, you know, somebody comes in for a shot where they'll look at their background and go, no, you don't need this shot. Look at all this stuff they're taking. You're gonna mess yourself up. I mean, where is that filter? I mean, right now it seems like your doctor is the commercials on TV,
right?
Which is, I don't think where you want to go on that.
I saw, you know, care situations like that overseas. I mean, I had a couple bad bouts with throat infections over the years when I was traveling. Like, you know, out of desperation, I went to this clinic in London. I was just with the great unwashed. I mean, my health care wasn't, my insurance wasn't any good there, pretty much. But, you know, I saw a doctor, you know, waiting 10 minutes. He gave me a prescription for something I'd never heard of that you can't even get in this country. And I snapped back after 2 or 3 days. You know, I thought I was going to have to come home. I felt so sick. But I can't imagine doing that today anywhere in the world and coming away from it, you know, with a good feeling about it. So.
Well, a lot of people are going to, what's the MS? There's treatment in Mexico and in Russia that essentially, allegedly, I know somebody who did this, is a cure. And it's not done here yet, but you can fly to Mexico. She flew to Mexico and came back, and she hasn't had a problem since she got back. She was dying from it. We need, and, you know, Jimmy really needs, is, you know, the stem cell treatment that they use, like, in shoulders and knees and stuff? That allegedly works pretty well. I mean, I anecdotally, one of the guys who used to play football for Notre Dame and was an NFL player for a long time, and is, you know, pretty banged up, go figure, said the stem cell stuff really worked in his knees. Did not work so much in his back, but it worked in his knees pretty well. But there's actually a, if you go Mexico or overseas, Jen, you can get a stem cell treatment for your whole body. Like, you just start everything new. I know I could use that. They put it intravenously or in your bloodstream. But you have to go either to Europe or Mexico, but Europe's the best. Matter of fact, the center for it is in Italy, of all places. And the reason why is they can still use cord blood over there, but we can't here. There's a lot of stuff people go, I mean, Audrey knows all kinds of people that are going overseas for plastic surgery. And you're in some hospital, you're in like a big hotel for a week or two. It's not, and I don't know if anybody's had a bad experience. I mean, we think we have the best here. I'm not so sure we do. And you sure as hell aren't like at a big hotel, and they don't keep you for a week, do they?
No. Are you kidding?
Boot you out the next day, for God's sake. Okay, what do you make of, we got a couple minutes. The thing in L.A., not good. By the way, do we have Audrey?
I don't see anybody else in the meeting
today. Audrey's not, yeah.
Actually, I just saw her, yep.
Well, let's talk about that. We're going to get to the thing in L.A. Is it going to get worse or better, Jen, or no? You don't know. Nobody knows.
I think things will happen pretty fast. There'll be a turning around to this, it would be better if you could get cooperation from the locals about this stuff so that the guard wouldn't have to be called in. But when the guard is called in, when the locals, the governor and the mayor, kind of opposed to that and stirring up factions.
Tear gas and fire hose.
Yeah.
Well, it hasn't happened since 1965. Usually the governor requests the president to do this. The last time this happened, I was in Alabama in 65. Anyway, Aud, we got you and welcome. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning.
Kind of a nice day until the wildfire dust gets back. It's pretty clear right now. We're a little late having you on here, but what's going on in the real estate world? And you and Jan can talk because he knows more about it than me. I know you're pretty busy. Nancy and I talked last week that you're kind of in the spot where a lot of people are trading cash purchases back and forth, and Nancy says the amount of new people piling in is not normal. I mean, it's way less than normal. Are you confirming that, or what would you say is going on?
It's still busy. It would help if we would get the Fed to knock the interest rate down a little bit for people, because it's just too high. It's too high. It's ridiculous. But there are still people. Where I'm at, if it's the next house again, it's just like what my same song stands for last year. If it's a nice house fixed up, we're still getting multiple offers on it, and anything that's nice is going under contract in a day or two yet.
The buyers are mostly people selling another place, mostly cash buyers or not?
No, not at all. Not people really, are getting mortgages. If you want a place to live and you're don't have a house to sell, you're going to have to get a mortgage. So you may not get as big a house or as nice a house, but you need a place to live. So you just have to go with the flow and hope that you can refinance at a lower rate down the road.
Well, I mean, if you've been in the business a little while, even though you're young, but it's the rate during most of your career has been around 6%, right? 6 to 6.5.
Well, the average long-term rate is 8%, even though people don't really think about it over the years. It was 8% all through, I want to say, the 70s. 80s, early 80s, before we hit the 20% mark. People don't even believe that interest rates were 12, 15, 18% for a long time.
Well, you'd much rather have that at the housing prices, at the prices at the time they were, right, Jen? I'd much rather play a place where, money either. Yeah.
It was relative. We were making less money. The houses were cheaper, so.
But it always
and now you've got the dual income that you didn't have then. So unfortunately, that's what you also is also different is you need that dual income usually to qualify for something in where you want to live in the school district. You've got kids, you want a nice house. So most of the time, both parents are working.
Yeah, that's unless you get the kids working, I mean that's a massive change, and we talk about that with Carl a lot. The salary's not going up so fast, and you're gonna have the prices going up faster than the salaries. And what people have done to take care of that, for lack of a better term, as Aud says, you don't have two people in the family. But if it keeps going, Aud, who are you gonna send to work? The dog?
No, let the dog stay home and enjoy himself. We did in the early part here. There was another dramatic acceleration in prices in the area. They're kind of just bumping along the top here now, I think. So, but if somebody's willing to do a little work and on a fixer upper, there are starting to be a few, decent deals to be had. So people should turn their nose up at doing a little work, because you could make yourself some nice little instant equity there.
Well, but now when you say doing a little work, that's what Nancy was talking about last week, is that most people, when they buy the house, they don't. It's not a question of work. There don't have any money left. There's no way. I mean, you've had some houses and you've been involved. I know you have some guys that do remodeling that love you finding them the fixer upper, and then when it's done, you sell it for them. And you've done that several times since I've known you. But those guys, they're not just putting. I mean, what's the average amount that they put in? 50, 60, 80? I mean, depending on the place.
Well, it depends, but that's different. That's their living.
Yeah.
And they're not going to buy something unless they get it for a rock bottom price to make money. I'm talking about the average person who doesn't have to have the HGTV ready house, who'd be willing to go and say, you know what? I can roll up my sleeves. I can clean it up. I can paint it. I can put new flooring in it, and maybe I can live with it. Then what people don't realize is that a house is almost like a living thing. It needs attention. So every year you should have a project that you're doing to improve your house, so that all of a sudden in 5-10 years or whatever, you go, oh my God, my house is so dated, nobody wants it. If it's like anything else, if you keep it up and everything is a plan for a year, every 2 years, you're going to have a beautiful house that you'll enjoy. You'll also have something that's...
Well, your volume's going up and down. Are you wandering back and forth from the mic?
No, my internet is very unstable. Thank you, AT&T. It keeps telling me it's unstable this morning.
Unstable. We know people like that. By the way, your name was being bandied about in the bar last Monday.
Why? Did that come up with the word unstable or what?
No, it came up with what you're talking about with the houses. No. I mean, and I wonder
where that segue was coming from.
Well, I mean, okay. Jimmy was there, so he understands. I mean, your mic's still on, Jimmy? I don't know, I'm not hearing you, but...
Yes, my mic is still on.
But because one of the things I mentioned is we're so used to in the last the denizens that live in the U.S., or at least in the nicer places, are so used to the prices going up that you don't even really realize that if you buy a place, and actually, Odd, you're the one who clued me into this, so I'll give you credit... for another piece of information that I have that nobody cares about, is that people buy a house. Let's say they buy for $250, and they live there for 10 years or 12 years. If they don't get $260 for the house, they think they got robbed, right? Or they somehow screwed up, or the world did them wrong. And yet, if you explain to them, well, you know, you wore this place out $50,000.
What do you mean? Only $10,000?
No, I'm saying, I mean, you pretty much, well, I mean, even if you keep the place nice, you didn't put a dime in the bathrooms. They look old because they've been used for 12 years. The kitchen's the same way. By the way, you haven't done anything to the windows. They now look like pretty shabby. You need $50,000 just to get this place back to the way you walked in. They look at you like you got four heads. Well, what do you mean? So you're the one who turned me on to this when you were talking about those condos at like 103rd and Central. Where he said they went for 170, now they're 150, but everyone needs $20,000 to get back to what it looked like when it was 170. No, nobody thinks of that at all. But Jimmy, you're in the mortgage business. Does anybody even remotely think of wear and tear on their house?
Yeah, I'm having a hard.
You hear me? Or your internet is unstable, huh? Because everything's fine on this end. But does anybody even realize that houses need maintenance? I mean, you wouldn't buy a car for 10 years and expect to get more for it after 10 years after you wore it out.
There's a difference. A car is one in a million. A property is not. A car is one in a million every year.
Yeah.
There are a million cars that come off the line, right? Not a million houses that come off the line every year.
Well, I'm saying that the inflation that we see, or the raising in prices, is actually more than it shows, right? Because you're not only selling a house for $100,000 more than you bought it 10 years ago, you also wore the hell out of the place.
The adage simply is, even the worst house on the best block is worth something.
Well, that's because of the property part. Yeah, I get it. But I'm saying...
I mean, if you want to live in, let's say, Lincoln Park, you're going to pay Lincoln Park prices.
Well, that's true.
If you want to live in Rogers Park... You're going to debt. It's just, it's how it's operated. I mean, in my former line of work, we had this debate all the time. We had people, it's a complete disaster, this or that, but it's in Manhattan.
Yeah. Yeah, well,
well, I mean, anyone yeah. knows that Manhattan is an island. You can't build anything without knocking something down. So therefore, it has value. You are going that. I mean, I know in my case, I'm thinking of selling, and I would be in what you have said. But I live in Lincoln Park, so it doesn't matter whether right. I did for 20 years or not. Someone will be willing to pay a price for
it. Somebody will give you a price and knock it down.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Tom, you live in the same. How many new houses are going up? New properties? A lot. And they're paying, what, 1.7 for the lot?
Yeah, I don't know. I have no idea. Jan, have you been in from Lincoln Park lately?
Oh, my God. Well, and Lakeview. I mean, where I lived from Belmont Racine 30 years ago, I think 80 or 90% of places on my street, Clifton Avenue, have been demolished and replaced with enormous, you know, state-of-the-art condo buildings, single families. The building, I mean, you wouldn't think that such a transformation could happen in such a short time period, but it's happening all over.
Well, some of the housing, we totally lost the order. She just messed with her internet.
Yeah, it looks like she's gone.
Yeah, I think she was having issues with the thing. I don't think she could hear us at all, but it's... Yeah, you wonder. I mean, obviously the footprint. You want to be close to public transportation, or at least you used to want to be. I mean, you don't have to drive everywhere. You want to be in walking distance when you get home. You don't have to get back in the car to go to dinner or something. You don't mind walking to a place. There's a huge appeal to that. And like Jimmy says, you're never gonna. I mean, location, location, location. But I mean, in general, you know, I mean, in Orland Park, people aren't really gonna want to. Yeah, I guess at some point, if the property's worth something, you just knock it down and start over. But you would hope that the house on the south side, especially in Beverly, the homes are so much, they're a little newer than the north side. So those things are more, you're just going to fix up the old place more than knock it down, right? Most of the time.
Yeah, and you can't really replace buildings like the ones in Beverly with yeah. anything like what's there. So.
And there's some on the north side that are like that. There's some neighborhoods that are like that. Because there's differences, but just in general, I wonder, you know, I mean, a lot of what, like what Aud was saying differently kind of than what I was saying, is that, yeah, if you walk in and all the rooms are the right size and everything is livable and it just needs a bunch of paint, well, guess what? You know, take a few years off us, Jan, we were capable of doing that ourselves. But if you walk in and you can't, if you're putting every nickel down on the mortgage, you can't attack a new roof the next day and put $40,000 on your credit card. I mean, it's no way to start, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you just can't do that. If it's the yard looks like crap, yeah. Can I spend 5 Saturdays in a row and go out there and fix the yard? Yeah. I mean, I don't need to, you know, or that kind of thing. But you know, you have to. I think right now people sort of need to be careful because of the stock market, any kind of fixed income, because I think we're outpacing people's ability to pay the stuff. I mean, and I don't... In 2007, imagine that, Audrey and I having a disagreement over the housing prices at that time, Jan, got to the point where, now this is not two incomes, that 85% of people in the country could not afford a median house, median price house. And I think now it's way worse than that. One of the guys that used to be on the show, and hopefully we'll be on again now that he moved back down, or he's got a job back downtown, was telling us he lives in Glen Ellen. And then the last, what do you say, Jimmy? Was it the last 10 years? His taxes have gone from $8,000 to $13,500.
Yeah.
And this year they went from, what, $12,500 to $13,500. So if you look back at the 2007 numbers that I was talking about, I don't see how anybody can afford a $400,000 house, which is the median. Let's put it this way. $400,000 house with the median. Taxes for a house like that got to be at least $1,000 a month. Insurance has done nothing but go up. I don't know what's insurance, Jan. $250 a month, something like that? $200 maybe?
Yeah.
I'm going to say that you have to be in the... If your wife's not working or the husband's not working, could be either way, I think you got to be in the 90th percentile of income to afford the median house right now. Maybe 85, but I think it's worse than it was in 2007. And I'm not going to predict anything bad happening or anything like that, but all I'm saying is those numbers cannot stay like that for a decade, or else who the hell can get in these places?
Okay, I'm back.
Okay. We're talking about median prices in Glen Ellen. One of our guys was telling us Sunday night his taxes went up $1,000. The last 10 years, they've gone from $8,000 to $13,500. Now, they haven't been that bad in Orland, has it?
Oh, yeah. When I bought my house, my taxes were, let me think, $6,800, and they are now right around $12,000.
So they've almost 45% in 10 years. That's kind of a lot. That's essentially double the CPI. It's at least double the CPI.
Wow.
It's been 20 years, but still, it's a lot. Taxes are it's crazy. And most of the taxes in Orland go to the school district.
That's pretty much everywhere, though, right? It's like 55% or something.
I'd love to see what the waste of that is.
Well, yeah, it's another.
That's going to, yeah. You have Doge out there to go through. I'd love them to go through Illinois tax rolls.
That would be... Talk about a rabbit hole.
Yeah. The pension fund is where I would start. I would start with the pension fund.
Rat hole, I should have said.
Yeah.
No, black hole.
Black hole.
Rat condo. You can pick any department in Illinois and go down that disaster.
Well, we had an interesting discussion. My brother had dinner. He has every Sunday. We show up, and it's almost like the Blue Bloods dinner, I guess. So we're not, except we're not all policemen. We had a conversation regarding whether the patronage system or the civil service system, or now we don't. I can't even describe the system, was actually better for public stuff. It's interesting because I'm not sure. I mean, at least my nephew's wife is a teacher, and I won't say what district, but she can rattle off stuff that is absolutely amazing. I had a kid in class, and he had serious learning problems. I'm not going to say he was, he had learning problems. And now the guy is the head instructor for a school, which we'll go nameless. He's the head swimming instructor. He doesn't even understand that he has to lock the pool door at night. They found it open when he's done. And oh, by the way, if somebody starts floundering in the water, he's not capable of going in and saving them. I said, you got to be kidding me. No, but he's somebody's son. The patronage jobs that people that I knew got when I was young, God help you if you screwed up and your uncle, if your uncle got, somebody said, hey, your nephew's a stumble bum. Everybody was so terrified of that, John. The patronage jobs, they were the best people, like my aunt said. Everybody wanted kids like that. They were the best workers they had. What's the story? I think most of the patronage people, you got the job because you knew somebody, but because you knew somebody, the guy didn't want to be embarrassed. You better show up, right? How has that all changed? I don't mind Uncle Flanagan getting you a job as long as you do something.
There's no work ethic, though, and that's the problem. The big complaint with any employer now is nobody wants to work. Just showing up and not falling asleep every half hour, doesn't qualify you as a good employee. So until they get the fact that you're right, but you didn't want to embarrass your friend or your relative that helped get you a job, so you worked extra hard. Well, that's not as common anymore. And if you, all you have to do is, to your point earlier, go to a hospital, go to a store, and try to get somebody who knows what they're doing.
Well, you're flapping on and out. I think you better call your internet company and say, I need better.
It's few and far between. And they really don't reward people.
I wonder, Aud, you keep flying back and forth, but Aud has been doing some remodeling work, and they're dealing with one of the big box stores.
You know what? I'm going to call AT&T and complain.
I think you should do that right now.
Yes, I will call and complain about them. Sorry, go ahead.
Right. I'm saying Aud has been doing some work, and she's dealing with one of the big box stores, and she said it's scary. Nobody knows what they're doing. Nobody can track the order down. Nobody knows where
I'm
it is.
I'm signing off.
John, what is all that? Why? I mean, when you went to Home Depot 25 years ago, everybody had stock in the company. Everybody knew what they were doing. Now, what happens?
Well, I could see it at places like Jewel and other places I shop at where, the cashiers will tell you, well, so-and-so, I had this kid who was working here yesterday. I don't know where he is today. He's supposed to be here today. I thought he would be here. My bagger isn't here. They take a cavalier attitude to being there or working hard while they're there. And I hear this from people on the inside, too, friends and relatives who work in these places. They can't get dependable help. And that's a problem that goes way beyond, what they're being paid, because they probably think they're getting paid nothing like what they're worth, but they're not worth anything if they can't show up to work. So I don't understand it.
I was probably six summers during my various school places and spring break and Christmas break as a janitor. I never missed a day. Thought of missing a day. I had to go and undo the alarm at 5:30 in the morning. If I missed the day, they couldn't get in the door in some of the wintertime. how do you decide, you're just not showing up, you're calling off? Or I get 10 sick days. What do you mean? Are you sick? No. Did you call in sick? Yeah. Well, then you're lying. Nobody. When I say that to people, they have no idea what I'm talking about. So you call up and told somebody you're sick and you're not. Well, yeah. Well, why is that okay? What am I missing here?
It seems like people at a young age have bought into the idea that they are completely replaceable, even though they behave like they're God's gift to the world, but that they have a very low opinion, clearly, of how much they really matter in the big picture, so that if they don't show up, they don't really think in terms of who's picking up the slack for me today. What if my customer who kind of liked me comes in and I'm not there and I have no excuse, and maybe I lost a friend here. The reason for that person to keep coming back to the store. They don't think in those terms.
Well, we got a dash from the trading floor was, get your ass in here. If it's slow and you got to go under the counter and sleep for an hour because you're hungover, you're doing it, but if I need you, you better be here.
Yeah, it's not too much to ask.
If you called in sick the day after Super Bowl, you got fired. it's harsh, but I don't have a problem with it, to be honest with you.
As long as people follow those instructions and realize this is how a system works, if everybody is pulling in the same direction, you got a good operation. Once people start to bow out of that whole contract and decide it doesn't really matter if I'm here or not, clearly, why should it matter if anybody shows up?
Well, at St. John Fisher, grammar school, they had no, there was no such thing as an extra teacher or a sub or whatever. If somebody, they had four grades in every class, so it's 32 teachers, two kindergarten, that's 34. If somebody was deathly ill enough to where they couldn't show up as a teacher, the principal taught class. So that was not exactly a break if you were one of the kids. I don't ever recall anybody not being there.
No.
Once in a while people they'd be coughing away up there, but you had to be dead to not show up. And now I got my 10 sick days. What does that even mean? At Pullman, if they thought you weren't sick, they'd dock you for the day. If you were sick for a month, they'd pay you for the month.
Yeah. All you had to be was honest.
Yeah. I don't get it. Well, John, are we going to see you someday this week or next week?
Yeah,
or
yeah.
I told our buddy D that you have a car, and he goes, well, that's a danger in itself. You go, let me know where he's driving. I'll be parked. I thought that was kind of harsh. SP Futures up 7, NASDAQ Futures up 14. Jimmy, thank you. Ricky, nice job. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.